You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
Okay, I retired from Georgetown as something called Distinguished Professor Emeritus.
Yes.
And I think at Oxford I'm referred to as the heavy-set fellow with a beard.
Outstanding. Are we recording this? Because I want to hear it. You guys are listening to Professor Daniel Robinson, my academic hero. I'm so excited to get him. He's got a course that I've listened to twice, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, another course called The Great Ideas of Psychology. Professor, I think I've written 17 books, edited 30. You are Professor Emeritus at Georgetown University, which is a fancy way of saying you're retired. You teach at Oxford University. And I got so many questions. I'm so excited. And I guess you're now retired. You teach at Oxford. How do you say? Let's just get it out on the table. You're probably the smartest man in the world. I mean, somebody's got to hold that title, and I'm giving it to you here on the
Brian Callen. Well, I'd hate to be the fellow in second place.
I understand, but you have, you know, it really is exciting when I listen to you. It's funny how much reading you've obviously done, and you know, you've lived a life here, and you've spent a great deal of that life really thinking about the big questions. So then at the end of the day, I find myself saying, I wonder what this guy, the man who studied all the great thinkers, immersed himself in the best that's been thought and said, I wonder what he thinks about every single day and what goes on in your head. You know, I don't know. I mean, what is your philosophy at the end of the day?
Well, you know, Brian, there's a marvelous scene in Enchanted April, if you've seen that film.
I have not.
Well, several women decide to free themselves from the constraints of marriage in the late Victorian period, and they're successful in renting a villa in Italy. And in different ways, they actually come to find themselves through this experience. But one of them, who is very, very aloof at the outset, absolutely unapproachable, wants very little to do with the two women who've pulled this together, is old now. And her early friendships included Matthew Arnold. You referred to the best things said and thought by the human race. That's a famous line of Arnold's out of Culture and Anarchy.
Ah, who knew?
And she's known these people personally. She has pictures of Carlyle and other notables. And she starts talking to herself in her room one evening as she looks at these pictures, and it dawns on her that all of her quote friends close quote are dead. And although they were very great, they have nothing new to say to her because they have nothing more to say. Well, you know, Descartes says a person who spends too much time in a foreign country becomes a stranger in his own land. So, yes, to live with the ancient Greeks and to get up every day thinking of those clever wits of the Enlightenment and so forth, it's a life of enchantment. It's also a very daunting life. It puts on notice most of the things we take for granted 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. But that much said, the sun comes up, it's 2013, and one has to recognize the problems of this world at this time. One can use the past as a guide. At least we ought to be able to avoid most of the mistakes of the past. It's never a bad idea to consult one's betters, whether it's in art or music or sports or literature or, indeed, philosophy. But at the same time, it's highly unlikely that anything in the past will just be absolutely perfectly tailor-fit as we dress up for the day's problems. So, yes, I do live with those old dead Greeks, etc. occasionally enjoy the company of some living ones. The audience might enjoy this. Some years ago, Public Broadcasting and the BBC got together for a series It was an award-winning series titled The Mind. And this was to be a takeoff on an earlier series on the brain, on which I was an advisor. And I was also taken on as an advisor for the series on the mind. Well, there were various planning meetings at PBS in New York, and I was asked how I'd begin the series, and I said, well, we might want the first program to be The Search for Mind. We could show someone with a devastating amnesia, who retrograde amnesia, has trouble knitting together any two experiences more than a minute old, et cetera, et cetera. And I said at the time that they told me I'd be on camera, and I said, well, I'd probably begin by saying that the search for mind begins with philosophy, and philosophy begins in ancient Greece. So we hammer these things out. About a week later, I get a phone call in my office, and the executive producer says, well, we're getting ready to shoot this, Dan, but Athens is out. It's too expensive. I said, well, what are you talking about? Well, he said, you're going to refer to Greece, and I assume you expected. No, I said, you don't have to film there. I said, I can stand anywhere and say that. So they said, well, we're going to be filming you at Freud's house in London and Darwin's house at Seven Oaks. And here's a question I'll remember till I go to my grave. Are there any old Greek things in England? I said, yes, quite a bit, and a number of old Greeks who want it back.
Yeah,
that's right. There you go. You know, every time you speak, I just at the end of, you know, you're sort of, it's almost like a soliloquy. I want to sing a song, although I have a terrible voice. But you have such a great, concise way of putting things together. And, you know, as you were talking and you were speaking about living with the Greeks, you end one of your lectures about Socrates, and you always say, you know, I have young people who say, what should I read? I want to educate myself. And I always say, well, I think you should start with the Greeks. I think you should start with the dialogues and then go from there. And it's just my opinion. But, you know, you end one of your lectures, and not in this series, because I listened to the old one about a long time ago and now this new one, but you say Socrates must have been the loneliest man in the world because he was smarter than everyone else, because he probably thought about things and was in always in a position of teaching and maybe not so much in receiving. And I know you say it's a daunting life in some ways. And why is that? Is that because the answers are left for you to figure out and teach?
Well, you know, I don't think I'm early in seeing Socrates, jovial though he was and so forth, as lonely. If you take a look at one of the most raucous of the dialogues, the Symposium. And this is where Alcibiades is proclaiming his love for Socrates and how Socrates jilted him and et cetera. But at the end of this, everybody's been drinking all night, and there have been these learned and not-so-learned discourses on the nature of love and so forth. Plato gives us a Socrates who, alone in that group, gets up and, as Plato says, walked back home alone. And I think, you know, there's more to that sentence than the mere repertorial, by the way, one of the fellows in the party got up and went home. And I don't think one feels lonely in virtue of being any cleverer than anybody else. I think that if you take a look at the ongoing party and take great pleasure in the pleasure that the partygoers are enjoying themselves, you don't know whether to announce that this ship is taking on water or whether you ought to go in and have a final stroll around the dance floor yourself, whether you should pull the emergency cords and sound the alarm, whether what you think is taking on water is just some complex mode of achieving a kind of ballast that you didn't know of yourself. But you do get this recognition. It's almost like listening to a Strauss waltz. You know, the first impression a Strauss waltz has is one of gaiety and people dressed to the nines and so forth. But when you listen to it, there's a very definite farewell element in this. It's an age rather gently saying goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what one of the sources of loneliness is the recognition that if you really do use the standards of the best and the brightest in ages that achieved something extraordinary, you do get this sense that they are now either taken for granted or forgotten, and the menacing consequences of either taking them for granted or forgetting them. And at the same time, you don't want to be the bore at the party who says, I know you're having a good time, but do you realize that you're running pretty low on petrol, or that skipped beat you feel in your chest could be diagnostic for something serious? Or have you noticed your children are awfully stupid?
This is a very important point, though. You know, there are very serious issues to be discussed and problems to be solved. But, you know, when you bring up the important things at a party or whenever you get together with people, even people people that make a difference in the world, who have some power and whatnot, it's really considered rather gauche, isn't it, to say, well, you know, you
it's
may
gauche
like
to care.
It's gauche to care. It's gauche to try to solve a problem. It's goes to challenge other people's assumptions about what they think is true.
Well, you can even make it worse than that, and that is when you do, no matter how tentatively, record your concern. If, as a result of a wasted lifetime, you actually do so in academic terms, you know. I mean, at a certain point, Brian, and tell your audience and Hunter, after 50 years in this business, it's extremely difficult not to sound professorial. You'd almost have to affect the speech of somebody you know who lives in reality.
Well, you know, I have to stop you because if anybody's earned the right to sound professorial, it's you, sir. Don't sound professorial. You sound downright poetic. So let's just get that out there. And you really do. You are a poet. You're not just a psychiatrist or a I'm amazed at your biological knowledge. I mean, when I'm listening to the great ideas of psychology, I thought to myself, this guy knows, like, this guy's got a deep sense of biology on top of the fact that he knows philosophy. But continue on.
I did get started at that end of the field. My doctoral degree was earned in neuropsychology. When I was a young person, I used to publish a fair amount on visual biophysics and human brain function and so forth. And in fact, it was that actually got me interested in philosophy of mind and some of the profound issues in philosophy of law. You know, we are now in the sixth decade of the decade of the brain, in case you hadn't noticed it. You can't pick up a magazine without finding out that the love you have for puppies is based on something in the limbic system, that you thought you were making a moral decision, but it was your amygdala all along. I don't know that we're going to survive our success in these areas.
I was going to ask you that. You know, that was then the question I had, because as we learn more about the brain and our biology, and we learn that emotions and these kinds of things actually can maybe be measured with a number eventually, then it raises the question: a criminal other than maybe somebody who doesn't get enough serotonin to his amygdala or what have you? I mean, if we get to a point where we realize that even terrible people like serial killers are just brain damaged, and by the way, maybe we come up with a way to fix that brain, like it's a bad machine, and now they're fine. What does that say about morality? What does it say about all the things that we talk about self-control, about character, you know, and even for that matter, you know, and we'll get to this, but sort of the bridge between philosophy and religion. That's really, I wonder if that's thrown you for a loop.
Well, I'm inclined to accept Aristotle's analysis of the issue of character, recognizing it not as something given, but as something made, and self-made to a considerable extent, but of course, Aristotle, every ancient Greek knew that there was a pat phrase for it, polis andra didaska. Man is taught by the polis. It's one thing to say that we're responsible for the characters we form. It's another thing to recognize that in the formation of that character, everything counts. The music we listen to, the nature of the architecture that surrounds us, the quality of the discourse we engage in with others, the patterns of friendship, the lessons we learn in sports, in social interaction, the justice that is embodied in the laws under which we live. These and a thousand other elements, 24/7, are interacting with this extremely protean, plastic, adaptive thing called ourselves. And it's a lifelong process. And so the business of character building is never over. All of the ancient tragedians were of one mind on this, that best not to say anything about anybody's life until it has ended, because at any point in the arc of life, something unforeseen can crop up. Now, we take these things for granted. There are people who spend the savings of a lifetime to go off and see a cathedral at Chartres or the ruins of an ancient Greek civilization. How many people are going to spend a fortune of a lifetime to come and look at the Pan Am building? And I don't mean to depreciate it, but I do want to make a point. If you look at the most celebrated architectural works of the past 40 years, these, in fact, are testimonials to architects. It's somehow, oddly, about them. And so you That's look at a building as a way of seeing how someone says you should be looking at a building. Well, this completely reverses the order of things as that order existed from the very dawn of classical architecture, in any case. You know, between 1150 and 1300, over 100 Gothic cathedrals went up in the British Isles and the European continent. We probably could identify the architects of maybe half of them. And the understanding then wasn't that these extraordinary achievements are sort of the genius of one person who's prepared to share his genius with the mere mob. These were understood to be essentially dictated in behalf of, and indeed through, an instrument rather higher in the order of things than the architect and the members of the guild who build these things.
That reaching beyond yourself, that which you can measure, that an expression of our love for something bigger like God, right?
Yes, and in fact, how shall I put this? When the Greeks defeated Persia, the idea was to leave the burned wooden temples on the Acropolis at the time in place as an eternal reminder of what those blankety blanks had done. And it was chiefly through Pericles that that the Athenians got over it, cleared that stuff away, spent a very large fraction of the GNP putting up something that they regarded as most fully expressing their attachment to order, balance, harmony, proportion, reverence, piety, etc. And it's called the Acropolis. Well, that's, you know, over two millennia ago, and it holds up.
It sure does. It sounds to me like you're making an argument for the value of the belief in a god. Because, and I wanted to ask you that, because you do a wonderful job of arguing when you talk about I don't know. He's one of the founding fathers of Christianity, and I'm blanking on his name, which is crazy. But you draw this bridge between the Stoics and Christianity. You essentially make an argument for the fact that, yes, Rome was up to its ears in Greek philosophy. Its documents were written in ancient Greece. Its children were tutored by Greeks. And yet, if you look at Plato's Republic, if you tried to live by Aristotle's biology, you would still come up short. You would still realize that this is a world where there are slaves and some people are worth more than others by their very birth, their very skill set, their the color of their skin. It wasn't until this Christianity, this Judeo-Christian ethic came along and said, hey, we are all of the same moral worth. We all come from one single source. I had never thought of it in those terms.
Well,
I had never
we all
thought
have
of
the
that.
Same father, according to that teaching.
Sure, but man, do we take that for granted, because that is part and parcel of our justice system in this country. And I would argue that's something that makes this country such a powerful force in the world, powerful force for good, in the notion that we are a country of laws. That comes directly, it seems, from that Judeo-Christian ethic.
Well, you have to be careful as well, because, I mean, so much of what our justice system is, it comes out of English common law, which a large part of that seems to come out of Germanic roots. The Germanic tribes were incredibly egalitarian, and in fact, a lot of hunter-gatherer tribes are. So the question is, you know, are we really, do we draw the line back to Christianity, which exists all across Europe, or do we draw the line back to, you know, the Germanic, you know, People's Council,
Professor,
where everybody has a say?
Professor,
yes.
Your answer, sir?
My answer?
It's a daily double, by the way.
We're in a unique position here because unlike any identifiable country in the history of the world, the one we're privileged to live in was actually founded by people whose names we know, and on dates we can actually establish with a calendar. Mm-hmm. And as they were extremely well-read and gabby, we know what their sources were, and more particularly, we know what the sources of their thinking were not. They were students of failed republics. I don't think any of them found it necessary to go back to Germanic tribal modes of organization, but they certainly understood what got Rome into the status of a republic and what killed it in the end. They fretted constantly about a continent the size of this one being able to sustain a republican form of government.
You're speaking of the Founding Fathers.
I'm speaking of the Founding Fathers. And as far as English common law is concerned, I would want to make two points, Hunter. First, the alleged distinction between Roman law and common law, as if the two had a kind of parallel development and common law somewhat independently taking on the burden of developing itself, I don't think that will bear the weight of historical fact. Common law elements were parasitic on older Roman understandings from the outset, actually, or very nearly from the outset. The second thing I'd want to point out is I'm going to get awfully teachy here. You've got to forgive me, but raising these very important questions.
We love it.
Probably the best mind of the 55 people who were in that hot, sweaty room in Philadelphia
James
those
Madison.
Months. Probably the best legal mind was the mind of James Wilson, who was a native Scot. George Washington would appoint him to the first U.S. Supreme Court. That was a time, by the way, when every justice, there were five of them, would write an opinion on any case before them. But in the first major jurisdictional dispute settled by a U.S. Supreme Court, lawyers in the audience might remember this as Chisholm versus Georgia, it was Wilson's opinion that proved to be historically most significant. In that opinion, as well as in his lectures on law, Wilson makes a fundamental distinction between John Locke's conception of rights and what Wilson wants the world to understand the founders' conception of rights to be. And I say this as a remedy for those who think that that what the founders came up with was a kind of reheated, you know, John Locke's letter on tolerance or his second essay on civil government. There were strong reservations about how Locke got to his position. Because, in fact, if you try to match the John Locke of the treatises on civil government with the John Locke of the essay concerning the human understanding, there really are points of conflict that I would argue are irreconcilable. Locke, in the essay on the understanding, is a dyed-in-the-wool Newtonian. He is an older friend of Isaac Newton's. He adores Newton. He understands the Newtonian worldview to be the worldview. That's it. Bob's your uncle. And according to that view, all of physical reality is finally reducible to a corpuscular substrate, what today we might call a subatomic substrate. So Locke wants to get us out of the habit of thinking of ourselves as having some real essence that transcends the physical, etc., etc. He says, look, you want to make a distinction between the real essence of things and the nominal essence of things. The nominal essence of something that I'm using to keep papers down on a windy day is paperweight. But that same object could be an object of assault in a war. It could be something used in a game. In other words, what we come to call the thing depends on how we're using it.
Mm.
Now, that very line of reasoning then would convert a human being into something called a lord or a baron or an earl or a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or a cook. All of these names that we assign to people come about by way of convention, by way of practice and habit. They're cultural artifacts, not unlike pots and pans.
Mm.
Now, if you do that, then the notion that in that entity, in virtue of its real essence, it possesses something called an unalienable right, would simply be nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Locke would say so. But that would be the arc of reasoning in Locke on the essay concerning the human understanding that would get you into that bind.
Mm.
Wilson thinks that that just as the Scots common sense philosopher Thomas Reid has corrected Locke and others on all sorts of metaphysical mistakes, he also corrects Locke and Hume and company on any number of other basic metaphysical mistakes by showing that the concept of an individual as a being with innate powers, agentic moral powers, which could not be got from the outside, constitutes human life as a very special kind of life, one that's fit for the rule of law, and that is answerable to the authority of conscience itself. So what Wilson wants the world to understand is that at least in this new world, rights are not nominal essences. They are part of the real essence of an individual. In Chisholm versus Georgia, where Georgia claims it can't be sued because it has something called state sovereignty, Wilson does an extraordinary analysis, pointing out, first of all, that the word sovereign appears nowhere in the Constitution of the United States. So he says we have to find out what that term refers to.
Mm-hmm.
And then in an absolutely summoning moment of jurisprudence, Wilson concludes by saying, we see then that sovereignty is in the man.
Mm.
Now, once you begin with that, you have left Germanic tribes, Roman law, the House of Parliament. This actually is an extraordinary event in human political history. I wish our students knew more about it. I wish they knew more about the people who brought it about.
Because in that moment he was saying that sovereignty resides in the man. In other words, the most important thing is this one is the individual and his life. That should be held at paramount importance.
Governments are here for him, not vice versa.
It sounds as though that's Spielberg's next movie. Now.
Well, hold on. The thing I was going to say, though, is, I mean, you know, I mean, that's a formalization of that idea, right? That sovereignty begins in the man, because, you know, the Enlightenment is playing around. I mean, Wilson may be the first to really articulate it, but, you know, what I'm really talking about in terms of English common law, of course, all of those laws are borrowed from each other, and, you know, the Napoleonic Code borrows a lot from other codes of law and so on and so forth, but the real departure, and I think the benefit that the Founding Fathers had in 1776 that is not appreciated, is that England had already gone through the Glorious Revolution, you know, and rule of law had really been established in the English-speaking world, where Parliament was above the king. And that was unique. I mean, you know, why did the French Revolution fail? The French Revolution failed because, you know, you tried to move straight from an absolute monarchy to a democracy, whereas, you know, the Americans, we had the benefit of already having rule of law and then trying to progress from rule of law.
Well, it's kind of what you were saying, Professor. They had the benefit of studying all the things that did not work. And so, and we're students of that, and so we benefited from so many mistakes in the past.
Well, you know, far be it from me to cast the decisive vote, let's say, for Edmund Burke against Tom Paine or Edmund Burke against Macaulay. The debate on how best to understand the difference between the American and French revolutions is going to go on. It's a rich and productive debate. I tend to side with Edmund Burke on this, granting the insight and power of arguments on the other side. But Burke was of the mind that if you examine the literature and the actions that were impelling the French, these were and were self-consciously at the expense of all of the traditions, all of the fundamental principles that had made France great in the first instance, that in understanding the unwholesome relationship between the crown and the church, the French got it into their mind to disabuse themselves of both. And this then left them open to almost anything. On the American side, what the protest was about was the failure of George III and his government to honor the very principles that had been abiding common law principles in England. That is, if anything, the American revolutionaries, so-called, were insisting on a far more scrupulous allegiance to core principles, so that when when the smoke cleared, the people in this new world and under this new government were not left in the ridiculous position of having to discover all over again what it takes to have a government, because they had never rejected the principles on which any fair and decent government depends. The war was about just those principles. Now, one might say that's a rather romantic gloss on, after all, what wasn't Hancock a shipping magnate, et cetera, et cetera. Well, look, fellows, I'm 76 years old. I'm in a sentimental phase of life, you see. And with a tear in my eye, I look back at those characters, many of whom died poor. Wilson, by the way, had to run south to stay out of debtor's prison.
Oh, no. God. There's no justice.
We've got this picture of a collection of slave owners, you know, drinking lemonade with mint in it. That really doesn't summarize the group of 55 very well at all. They showed up in Philadelphia. Some of them had to leave because they couldn't afford to stay there. There weren't any subventions, you know, by the colonies sending people there and putting them up. they were bunking together in various rooming houses and doing the best of it. A lot of them were writing letters back home saying, I wish this damn thing would come to an end. It was tough business. They argued all the time.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, the fact that none of them, besides maybe Edmund Burke, but there was no violence, there were no fisticuffs. They just kind of, they saw, you say it. I mean, these men solved the political problem.
They did. In fact, they did it so well that it has taken us the better part of 200 years to undo what they put together.
That's right.
And we're very resourceful.
Yes, yes. Well, yeah, I would imagine that we are in danger of losing our republic in many ways. You're 76 now. You've spent your life in contemplation, I'm sure in action as well. But where do you come down on religion? Are you a religious man? Has your religion changed? Have you become more religious, less religious? And what does religion mean to you?
Well, time for full disclosure. my sainted Irish grandmother, who, owing to the fact that my parents worked, had a lot to do with my very early upbringing.
Mm.
Of course, you can't have an Irish grandmother without
being dragged to church.
But you know, Saint Michael the Archangel was. I can tell you this: that when I finally got old enough to go out with some of my friends, my grandmother's parting shot would be, and I'll do it in her brogue. Now, remember, Dano, don't do anything that would offend the Blessed Virgin. Now, if you've got your hand on the doorknob getting ready for a big Saturday night, and the last thing you hear is don't do anything that would disturb the Blessed Virgin,
there goes your fun.
Have already planned to do things that not only would disturb the Blessed Virgin, but have her running down the street like the Edvard Munch scream. You know? So I did go to Catholic boarding school from the time I was 8 till I was 12, and got a good start on what I think Marlowe referred to as small Latin and less Greek. And was an altar boy, as one should be, et cetera, et cetera. Now, to be a Catholic without ever going through a Joycean dilemma is really to be a Catholic in a sleepwalk.
Without those long chapters on what hell's really like. Oh,
yeah,
God. I remember reading that. Poor James Joyce. No wonder he left Ireland. Oh, I mean, come on.
But I would say this, Brian. I'm not dodging the question, but I do want to set up the answer to it. When I've been asked about Roman Catholicism, I do try to point out that that's a term freighted with very different meanings. And the differences have to be kept in mind, even if at the end you think there's some sort of integration that's possible. First, there is the historical fact of Roman Catholicism. It's a human institution. It was not, God did not come down from the throne of heaven, put together some nice places in Rome and declare Habemus Papam. So this is something pulled together under very, very difficult circumstances. One can only guess what its fate would have been had there not been a Constantine, etc., etc. Had there not been a challenge from Islam. So there's that human institution. It's among the oldest in human history, like all other human institutions of long standing. Its record of success, failure, ignorance, brilliance, etc., it's a mixed one. And I think anybody who wants to bet on all eternity solely in terms of the achievements of a human institution is headed for trouble. So there's that.
Mm.
It's also a body of doctrine, and for people with a scholarly bent, That's an extremely interesting aspect of Roman Catholicism, because the arguments within and against the Church began as soon as its influence became palpable. I think that's someone trying to bring this line.
No worries.
And that body of doctrine has developed over a period of centuries and centuries. But many people do know the main players in that, but this doesn't begin and end with Thomas Aquinas. This includes just about every celebrated skeptic in history. It's married priests, it's Italian surgeons, it's everybody in the game who has a quill and something that passes for ink is penning questions, penning challenges. When the medieval university finally gets going, there are public debates and disputes and so forth.
Over scripture, you're saying?
Well, over scripture and over the very organization of the church,
right.
Over church
right.
offices, over the authority of the Pope.
It didn't start and end with Paul, in other words.
Well, I'm talking about since that time.
Yes, yes.
Paul and Peter themselves are engaged in a kind of dispute. But the Paul that I would point to is the Paul standing on street corners arguing with Greek philosophers.
Mm.
Because centuries later, Paul-like figures are carrying on arguments in manuscripts with Avicenna and Averroes and Hebrew scholars in the Islamic world. So this is going on and on and on. Remember, until relatively late in the game, it was only Islam that had significant works by Aristotle. You know, the Western world had, I think, his Categories and the logical works. But you can imagine the momentous consequences when out of Moorish Spain, out of Islamic Spain, chap shows up with a manuscript under his arm, and it turns out to be Aristotle's Metaphysics. This was a game changer, and a relatively late development. I mean, if you work my side of the street, 12th century is, you know, recent history.
Right.
So that body of doctrine, far from being a shut up, I explained mode of church teaching, is exhaustive. It's incredible. Here, I give you a couple of instances. Just take aspects of canon law. I'll give you things that Roman law never had to deal with, ever, 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 and no part of the secular world would have to deal with. Can a mentally defective person receive the sacraments?
Hmm.
Now, if you take a look at the close analysis done here, which, by the way, would come to inform secular law. The close analysis goes something like this. A mentally defective or even a profoundly limited person can receive the sacrament of baptism because the sin that it removes was not the result of a volitional act by the person who bears the sin. But the sacrament of confirmation cannot be received by a mental defective because it requires full volitional power. So there's already a distinction between things for which we can be held responsible owing to our competence and things for which we get legitimate excuses owing to a lack of competence. Now, I give you that as one, this is a particle. This is an atom in an ocean of thought. So I would say that at the level of the development and doctrinal teaching, the Church probably enjoys the most sustained record of critical scholarship, I'm inclined to say, in the history of the genre.
Wow.
Staying neutral on whether or not one would reach the same conclusions, defend them.
One can be a man of the cloth and still engage in very vigorous intellectual pursuits and debate.
Indeed, though I think it would be the rare man of the cloth who had direct teaching in The doctrine I'm talking about fills the Vatican library. It's not,
wow.
You know, what a priest gets is really a snippet of that. I mean, it's not even a snippet. So there are those two things. Then there's something rather mysterious in which all those who accept the teaching, live life according to the teaching, are said to regard themselves legitimately as, quote, the body of Christ, close quote, which is to say that even on earth, in a mysteriously organic way, the community of the faithful constitute something of a living Christ on earth.
Mm.
Fellows, that is so far above my pay grade. I mean, so what do? I lower my eyes, I take a look at my shoelaces, I obey Chesterton's rule that part of the definition of a gentleman is that he never intentionally hurts the feelings of others. I think that there may be a deep fundamental truth in that. I would give up coffee to have a glimpse of it. I do think this is where faith enters, and I think it takes a strong and perhaps even, when I say a simple faith, I don't mean a faith that comes about as a result of a simple mind, but I think it comes about as a result of a mind capable of great economies and a great ability to increase the signal-to-noise ratio.
I love the way you speak. I just love the way you put things.
So, will my last living thought on earth, apart from the love I have for this bride of mine of 47 years, be a supplication to St. Michael that, would you please forget that interview I gave in California? it could be something like that.
Yes. Well, you, and I know Hunter wants to talk to you about William James because you say something.
Or it might depends on where I am at the time. Remember Oscar Wilde's alleged final lines as he lay dying in that dingy Parisian flat. It is said that the last thing he said was either that wallpaper goes or I do.
That's so great.
Well, and of course, you know, there's a story which is probably apocryphal, but that when King George III died, that, you know, one of his assistants came to him and said, "Sir, you have to go to Bognor Regis, which is a seaside town in England."
I've been there. I shot something for Discovery there.
And George III's response was, "Bugger Bognor."
Yeah. That place is terrible. I want to piggyback on what you've just, that wonderful and long soliloquy there again on you know, how you negotiate religion, because you say, I quote you all the time, and I heard it when I was a young man. I never forgot it, and I think it was William James whose rebuttal to Darwin, when Darwin said there is a designer without a design, we are nothing but pointy-tailed, pointy-eared hominids. And somehow
it was Matthew Arnold, actually.
Oh, okay, thank you, Matthew.
It was a wonderful debate in print between Huxley and Arnold. Do you think your audience would be interested in that? And you don't have to be polite.
Well, you need to let them know who Huxley was.
Thomas Henry Huxley was quote Darwin's bulldog.
Yeah.
He was a great naturalist and scientist in his own right. He was a veritable prince of debaters. He probably had more to do with getting Darwin finally to publish the thing than anybody else did.
Mm.
And he was an instigator. He saw a fundamental war between the world of science and that other, older world of rank superstition, ignorance, etc.
Well, I call it romance. You know, the way I negotiate it is that, you know, Huxley was a guy who said we are essentially we a man can be reduced to his mathematical biology, protozoa, etc. And this whole thing was a happy mathematical accident, or whatever you want to call it. Where then I think Arnold said, well, it may be true that we came from trees and we were monkeys, but there was something about that monkey that inspired it to Greek. something about that monkey that gave birth to things like Shakespeare, Mozart, Beethoven, the writings of Aeschylus and Sophocles, etc.
Yeah.
When you couched it in those terms, and then you said it was a little bit like, I think, taking a piano and smashing it into 1,000 pieces and saying that's a piano. Well, that may be a piano technically, but a piano's that box, when touched the right way, makes beautiful music. I choose to live in the romantic world that people like Emerson and Thoreau lived in, as a rebuttal to Darwin. I think you need both, of course.
Yes, the great sage writers. Mm.
That was life-changing for me. You changed my life with that, just so you know, but keep going.
Well, a wealthy industrialist, a man of commerce by the name of Josiah Mason, had given a very large gift to found what became Mason College, now absorbed into the University of Birmingham. And it was in the terms of the gift that Mason specified that at this college, quote, the humanities will not be taught, close quote, because Mason wanted this to be a technical school. Well, whom do you get to give the Founders Day address? Thomas Henry Huxley, and he gave a great address. And he congratulated Mason for his prescience and generosity. And then addressing the audience, he raises as a, not a rhetorical question, but an actual question. He says, suppose some youngster setting out on a course in life can choose between two curriculums of study, one featuring a pair of dead languages of use to some future reviewer of books, and one based on the laws and principles of science, whereby one comes to understand how the world actually works. And Huxley says, is there any doubt in anybody's mind as to which course of study should be pursued? He says, anybody but our famous Levite of culture, Matthew Arnold. Now, of course, he and Arnold knew each other, and I think this was just a bit of nose tweaking. But so this essay was published, and it now is the pretext for Arnold to reply. And he does in print in a wonderful essay titled Science and Culture. And it's in that essay that Arnold says, well, look, I can't debate Thomas Henry Huxley on scientific matters. Arnold says, quote, why, the unsystematic nature of my thought is well known from one end of this country to the other. And you can sort of feel it coming. You know?
Yeah. Says, setting it up.
I've been thumbing through, he's thumbing through Descent of Man.
He said, by the way, I like that he's saying thumbing through. It's so condescending. I've been thumbing through your life's work.
Yes, he says, where I find this passage, and this is a quote from Descent of Man, quote, our ancestor was a hairy quadruped with pointed ears and a tail, probably arboreal in his habits, close quote. And Arnold says, well, this is very possibly true. In any case, I'm in no position to dispute the point. But he says, there must have been something in this poor chap. There must have been in him a veritable necessity. Must have been something in him that inclined him to Greek. Now, what's the point Arnold seeks to make here? Well, the point he wants to make is this. Left-hand side, hairy quadruped, pointed ears, tail, up in a tree. Now, get out your yardstick, and at the end of a yard, this is going to be a measure of time, the age of Pericles. Here's a question. How do you get him from the tree to the Acropolis? Now, on the assumption that he's perfectly well adapted to life in the tree, he should stay there. Unless he has within him a veritable impulse to self-perfection, which is aided by and manifests itself in the humanities, in the arts, in music, in everything that transcends the plane of the ordinary and reaches to the level of principle. And Arnold is satisfied that is the best record and the best explanation we have of human life on Earth. It's broad cultural achievements, included among which, and even centrally, is the achievement of science.
Of course. But he's also arguing for a god, isn't he there? At least some...
Well, this is the Arnold, you know, of Dover Beach. He's rather resigned to the fact that that great wave of faith is receding back into a mindless ocean as ignorant armies fight by night. I don't know. Religion is a very difficult subject for the thinking masses, which is why when I hear today's most celebrated atheists, I say to myself, you know, with people that clever, they ought to understand that these things are rather too deep for that kind of treatment.
Yes, I would agree with that.
They're coming in, really, in the middle of a story that they either don't understand or refuse to understand or insist on distorting. The idea that the best explanation of human history is some DNA kind of thing constituting a nervous system with certain inclinations and so forth. You can almost hear the machinery clanging in the garden, for goodness sake.
I was going to say.
Serious people are under no obligation to take this seriously.
Yeah, human beings are just more complicated. There's just too much wonder in the world. I never really worry about that kind of stuff. But let me ask you something. We are now, with technology, 2013, it seems to me, and if you really listen and read people like Ray Kurzweil, I mean, he's talking about mind-blowing stuff, these futurists. The notion that, well, you'll be able to download people's memories, that we'll be able to have virtual experiences of what it's like to be each other. I might be able to tap into your brain someday.
Well, you can do it right now just by asking.
That's right. But I think
they call it cutting to the chase.
reading.
Perhaps, but, you know, we are being, it seems, with technology, nudged toward each other. There seems to be, at least in today's world, more of a singular mind as opposed to, say, 30 or 40 years ago when people had no idea how the other side lived. And I think that it makes me feel as though there's got to be a purpose to this. Why are we being nudged in the same direction? Why are we being moved toward one single consciousness? Am I being just too California for you here?
But no, I think if you can keep raising generations that believe that they actually have friends and can prove it by moving their thumbs very quickly and exchanging 95 notes a day, that of course is the end of social life. There isn't anything I would want to say to a friend of mine that I'd feel comfortable saying except by phoning him and or arranging to meet and sitting across and saying, I think there are some things we should be talking about. I can't do this with my thumbs. I might actually need some frontal lobe function for this. I very much worry Look, polis under the dask, a man is shaped by the polis. Man is shaped by his creations. And we can rearrange the manner in which our character and thought develop by coming to rely on technologies that constitute only one way of expressing thought.
Wow.
And so...
I never thought of it that way.
And look, here's an example. I always like to talk about what people are prepared to spend a lot of money on. They're prepared to spend a lot of money to go to Italy, and particularly Florence. People love Florence. What do they love about Florence? They love the architecture, they love the food, they love the way the city is laid out, the extraordinary collection at the Uffizi, etc., etc. Now, that place didn't just accidentally unfold. A good pope and a great architect by the name of Alberti actually sat down and planned the thing. And they asked such questions as, how wide should a street be in relation to the height of buildings so that one preserves his civic sense?
Wow. Wow. And scale to a human being,
It's geometric. It's harmonious. I mean, it's classically informed, et cetera, et cetera. When Alberti's finished, he summarizes this achievement of Florence in the Quattrocento. He summarizes this in a treatise which he titles In This Most Perfect Paradise.
Mm.
Now, we go there because being there, we are alerted to things that, I'm sorry, but we're alerted to things not excited by the McDonald's stand arches.
That's right.
And when you go into the Uffizi, if you go to the Medici Palace, one thing very interesting about the house the Medicis had built there when they came back from exile, they could have had Brunelleschi build the thing for them, and he actually did a model, as I understand it, which they just tossed away. The gardens were bigger than the Cardinal's gardens and so forth. If you walk the streets of Florence and try to find the Palazzo Medici, it's going to be behind, you know, big iron gates and so forth, but there are a lot of houses like it.
Mm.
Because the understanding was that part of what it means to be a citizen is fitting in, not standing out. Of course, once you get inside the house, this is obviously not a place owned by, you know, the local
butcher, yeah.
Philosophy teacher,
yeah.
Right? But I say if the human imagination is allowed to range over things that excite it, and I would say at any point from age 5 or 6 on, it invariably fixes on things in which the human imagination really has played the central part. And I worry that we are so numbing those sensibilities that we will lose sight of what makes things great, and we will settle for sparkle without substance.
I just love what you're saying. We have efficiency and abundance in this world, but we don't have what you're talking about. I do think we pay a price. You can just look around. I travel this country all the time. And it is less than inspiring. There is no architecture. And it goes back to, I never thought of the fact that the past 10, 15 years, 20 years, these architects are creating structures that reflect themselves,
yeah.
Not something bigger than you know, their own experience. I think magazines. I mean, look at magazines on shelves. It's all about your diet, the workout for you, what clothes look great on you this spring. It's no longer reaching for something you don't even know how to express, like the opera scene in New York, or the newest or the Met's newest showing of Picasso when he was nine, whatever it might be. Those are the things that inspire. I'm so glad that you were able to put that in those terms. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here, because it's you couldn't have put it, I guess, more succinctly and clearer. That's you just described why it's so important. You know,
I do give on a regular basis, generally a lecture a year at Princeton for the program they have there in American Ideals and Institutions, and I do want to be polite to my host, and of course, ultimately the host is the university itself, and you certainly don't want to say anything against its donors. But so I won't mention the particular building, but the lectures are given in a building there. Princeton has a very pretty campus. Whoever allowed this thing to go up. You know, it makes me rethink my position on the death penalty. and to stand there, I remember in one lecture I had occasion to refer to the art and architecture of the 18th century classic revival, because I'm talking about aspects of the founding, And as the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm looking around this room and saying to myself, if I had a hand grenade and could get the people out,
that's great.
But there it is. When Smith walks in, you know, with his checkbook and says, "I'm prepared to give you so much," and et cetera, and it'll be a great building for such and such, and I shall arrange for the architect, and so someone has to sit back and say, well, the gift will be greatly appreciated, but it is going to have to fit in, not stand out.
Harmony. It sounds like you're talking about harmony.
I remember my father used to say, if you can talk to a man for 10 or 15 minutes, walk away, and remember what he was wearing, he was improperly dressed. And my wife says that helps explain why, when she met me, I think my wardrobe consisted of four gray suits.
Well, you know, if we could see your brain, you'd be the best looking man in the world. So.
you're kind to old timers, but look, I tell you this, Brian, my will is written already, so.
And it's going towards a building at Princeton.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
It's going toward an unnamed demolition out there.
That's right. That's right. You're such a joy to talk to. I know you're probably a busy guy, and we usually keep this at an hour. I'm going to open the floor, though, to Hunter. You have any last questions for?
Well, I was looking through your bibliography, and, I'm a huge, huge fan of William James, and I think that, you know, it's such a tragedy that more people don't know about him. So, I mean, I think just sharing a little bit of, you know, what did William James stand for?
Best writer in that family. And I love Henry James.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Were they brothers, or they were...
Oh, yes, they were brothers.
Wow. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, there were wonderful letters between them. Bill, from time to time, would complain that he thought Henry was spending a little too much time abroad and actually ran the risk of becoming British.
If I put you on a desert island, Professor, I gave you 10 books, what would they be?
10 books? Well...
5 books.
First, you'd want to make sure.
Let's make it 5.
You'd want to make sure that you had some which, no matter how often you read, you were going to get something new out of them. And so, I would say Aristotle's Metaphysics would handle it. Mm. I gave for some years the core lectures at Oxford on Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, which many regard as the most difficult text in the entire philosophical canon.
You devote 2 lectures to Kant in The Great Ideas of Philosophy.
Yeah, well, the core lectures, 8 weeks on the fellow.
Wow.
I've written a book on trying to make him accessible. It's titled How Is Nature Possible? I probably would bring The Critique of Pure Reason with me. That would be a second one. Shakespeare, of course.
I'll give you the whole canon.
The Bible.
The Bible.
Yes, but first of all, in part because it shaped so much else. Certainly, Iliad.
What about Odyssey? Or is that the entire?
Well, I think Odyssey has one of the most magical romantic moments in the history of literature. I was giving lectures at Columbia between 2000 and 2005, I guess it was, course in the history of psychology. And I remember the first week I was sort of waxing almost sentimentally on Homer and so forth, and one of the young women in the class said, look, she said, I've read this in school. And she said, with all due respect, you know, from my point of view, it's just a lot of heads rolling in the sand. And she said, there isn't a romantic element in the thing. And so I said, well, I think there's a romantic element in it. And I gave her the account, you know, of...
1,000 ships launching for...
Well,
for
no, but Odysseus, you know, when he's sort of arrested by this absolutely beautiful sea nymph who she's doing everything to keep him, drugging him and so forth. And finally, Calypso says to him, she says, look, if you stay here with me, you will never change. In other words, she's promising him immortality. She's willing to make she can make a god out of him.
Mm.
And he chooses to remain Odysseus. He turns her down. He wants to go home. Because first he wants to preserve himself. And part of what it means to be Odysseus is to be the husband of Penelope.
Mm.
So he gets himself back there, and he's in disguise. You know, he's going to kill all the suitors, and he's really chuffed with anger and cleverness. And he is perhaps the most clever of those in the epic poems. He finally makes himself, the first one who recognizes him, even with the disguise, is his dog, Argos. You can never fool your dog, by the way.
Never.
And Argos is so astonished to see Odysseus back that spots him and dies on the spot, which is a rather telling moment. And then his wet nurse from years earlier, soon he swears her to silence, under a rather brutal threat, by the way. And then he makes it known to his son Telemachus that, yes, it's I'm alive. Tell your mother. Now, she doesn't believe it. I mean, she has gone through years of lamentation. She's looked at the estate being pillaged by these characters. Every one of them wants her hand in marriage, etc., etc. She can't believe it. He finally presents himself to her with the disguise removed. It's in their house and it's in their bedroom. She is overcome by the sight of him. And yet, there's a skeptical element. She thinks she may be conned by the gods or in some sort of state of delirium. And so she tests him. She says, you'll see that things are pretty much the way they were when you left, except the bed has been moved. Now, the bed was made by Odysseus himself, and one post of the bed is actually a tree, shaped as a post now, so it looks like a bedpost. And Odysseus looks at her and says, I made that bed, and that bed cannot be moved. And Homer at that point has this passage, as when men are lost in the turbulent brine of the sea, recognizing that they shall never again know the security of life on earth, etc., this whole thing. And just in case one of them, through good fortune or the intercession of the gods, should find his way to safety on the shore, so she wrapped her white arms around his neck and held him as if she would never let him go. I said to the girl, oh, is that romantic enough for you?
Hey, I'm producing estrogen. I'm swooning as we speak.
So I would bring Iliad anyway.
Okay,
The rhyme schemes are unbelievable.
Excellent.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to sound strange, I know, but I think I would bring the Handbook of Physics and Chemistry. just to have an infinite variety of numbers to fiddle with.
Amazing. What a mind you have. What a mind. I just love it. Professor, you make the world a better place, and we thank you for your
time.
Pretty
much by turning in early, I should think.
I could talk to you all day. I really could. I just wish I lived next to you. I'd bother you all the time. I'd be like one of those like those girls with the rock stars always waiting outside his door. Hey, professor, teach me more. Teach me more.
You're a good man, Brian.
Well, listen.
Infinite patience.
Please, you're fantastic. You've changed my life with your lectures and with your mind, with your effort. It's most appreciated. And you humble me with the fact that you would do this podcast. So I thank you.
Great pleasure.
And thank you so much. Listen, you're welcome back anytime. Anytime you have something you want to talk about, I'm always here. Consider me like the NSA, but not as promoting. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. And Hunter, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Cheers, then.
And we'll make all of we'll put links to all of your books on the page where this interview will be.
Yes, and
well,
teaching company.
Do that, but thank you very much, fellas.
Thank you.
You do good work.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. A saint, ladies and gentlemen. That's a saint right there. Fantastic. Just the way he kind of like just slowly teaches, and he's a romantic, and he's a scientist.
Well, it's like the auditory equivalent of like really dark chocolate.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That's fucking exactly what it is. He's so great. And it's like people come up to me in LA and they go, "You're smart. Hey, bro, I've read some books, okay? That's all I've done." That's like saying to the guy who plays tennis once in a while on the weekends that, yeah, he should be in the U.S. Open. Yeah. Shut up. That guy's brilliant. Thanks. Thank you, Hunter Motz, for getting Dan Robinson. And thanks, all of you, for listening. Hope you learned something. And there it is. All right. Peace.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.